Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's an oldie, but a goodie, and appropriate to the day, so we are going to use it. It's The Economy, stupid. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, the 6th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The first Tuesday, in point of fact, after the first Monday in November, Election Day, in case you've been living under a rock. The House, the Senate, local races, also 36 gubernatorial seats are up today, 17 of them in states with an incumbent on the ballot. And that is where we are going to start. The economics of one slice of American politics. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker has made the economy a big part of his message. And a big part of that message was the announcement he made with President Trump back in June that Foxconn, Apple's supplier, was going to build a big new factory in the state and with it create 13,000 new jobs. The Wall Street Journal reports, though, that the company is considering bringing in Chinese workers to help run that place. Shandy Rice shared the byline on the piece. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Remind me, would you, what incentives Foxconn was given to build this factory in Wisconsin?
The state gave them $3 billion in financial incentives, mostly in the form of tax credits. Then the local area where the plant is going to be located gave another $764 million in incentives. And then depending on how you calculate various infrastructure improvements, there's several hundred million more. So, you know, somewhere between $3 and $4 billion or north of $4 billion, depending on what you include. But right. On the state level, minimum of $3 billion.
In return for which, Foxconn promised $10 billion in investment over a certain period of time, but also 13,000 new jobs. And that's why we called you up, because of this article you share a byline on today, talking about how the company is planning, perhaps, to import Chinese workers to fill some of those spots.
Yeah, you know, the unemployment rate is obviously at a record low, but in Wisconsin, it's even lower. It's 3%. It's even gone below 3%, on top of which you have a real population growth problem in Wisconsin. People leave the state. They don't move into the state. The other challenge is that Foxconn appears to have changed their plans for the types of workers that they need. Originally, they were looking for manufacturing workers. Wisconsin is sort of this manufacturing hub. Now they're talking more about engineers. Racine County, where the plant is going to be located, is not really a hot spot for engineers. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, Foxconn is asking engineers in China to raise their hands and come on over to Wisconsin. And so far, it doesn't seem like people are all that excited about it.
Yeah, with the caveat that Foxconn says it's not true, they're not planning to do this. It is worth a mention here that Racine is some distance from the University of Wisconsin Engineering School, that it's cold up in Racine, lovely though it may be. I mean, there are some issues with getting people up there.
Yeah, I think that if they were trying to get just manufacturing workers, they probably would have had an easier time. In their original proposal back in June 2017, they were looking for like 9,000 factory workers. Now they're saying that they want to develop a research and development facility, and the majority of people that they're looking to recruit are engineers. Huh. So they've sort of turned the whole thing on its head.
When you sit down and pencil it out, these turn out to be, almost on a per-job basis, really expensive jobs for the state of Wisconsin to be investing in, if that makes any sense.
Yes, and a lot of people who are critical of economic incentives have noted that. And the state's argument is that Foxconn is going to create a Silicon Valley of the Midwest, and there will be this whole amazing ecosystem where there'll be just thousands and thousands of people moving to Wisconsin to work in high tech. That's a bet that Governor Scott Walker is making, but I think a lot of people feel that that's far-fetched.
Right.
Maybe?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you contextualize it with another article on which you also share a byline in the paper today, because clearly you've been busy, the Amazon HQ2 story about how them potentially splitting between two places because they can't find enough tech workers in one even large metropolitan location like New York or Washington.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you're thinking that a place like Amazon is going to have trouble finding the workers that it needs in places like New York and Washington, D.C., just imagine the challenges that Foxconn is going to have finding engineers in a place like Racine, most engineers probably haven't even heard of Racine.
Shandy Race, writing in the Wall Street Journal on a bunch of stuff today, actually, most recently Foxconn. Shandy, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right, so about that Amazon HQ2 story, 20 cities are nominally in the running, although Washington and New York do seem to have the inside track. But let's talk for a minute about the process of this economic beauty contest. More than half of the bids were submitted by public-private partnerships or area chambers of commerce. That matters because groups like that have limited obligations under transparency and public accountability laws. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains what's going on there.
Sam Bailey remembers when he got the big news back in January. Amazon execs had chosen his region, Metro Denver, as one of the 20 finalists for its new headquarters.
Amongst 238 proposals.
Bailey was responsible for that pitch as an executive director at the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation. It's a private group of business and elected officials across nine counties, and that gave Denver's pitch an advantage.
We're able to represent a breadth of communities, a breadth of workforces, and more when responding to projects like Amazon HQ2.
12 of the 20 finalists for Amazon's HQ2 were submitted by chambers of commerce or public-private partnerships like the one in Metro Denver. Some of those proposals have come under fire because those groups aren't subject to some public disclosure laws. Earlier this year, a New Jersey court forced Newark's Economic Development Corporation to release its pitch to the public. Attorney C.J. Griffin argued the case.
There's hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of tax dollars at stake. That's taxpayer money when you give tax breaks that impacts other people. So the public has a right to know.
But not every state requires agencies that work on behalf of the public to make their business dealings public. And some economic development officials think it should be that way. Michael Finney runs Miami-Dade Beacon Council, a public-private partnership which submitted another finalist bid. He says the way a proposal will succeed is by keeping it quiet.
You want to make sure that you are not tipping your hand with respect to how you're trying to compete economically with other regions.
Besides, Finney says, if Amazon chooses the city, the deal will have to go through a public process in order to get inked. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Sideways to generally up on Wall Street today as traders waited for the polls to close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Deep inside the Agriculture Department is an office called the Foreign Agricultural Service, which tracks, among other things, exports of key American crops, including soybeans, which gets us to this quite stark statement. The biggest export market for American soybeans is all but closed thanks to the trade war. Chinese counter-tariffs on American beans have led to a more than 90% drop in sales to China from a year earlier. And complicating things a bit, storage bins are already filling up with this year's bumper crop, so all the not-sold beans have nowhere to go. Marketplace's Andy Euler talked to some soybean farmers in the upper Midwest.
It's been one of the rainiest years on record in southwest Minnesota, where Bill Gordon's a fourth-generation farmer. He says wet conditions often mean spoiled soybeans.
We got the soybeans out without the rot, but storage was definitely an issue.
He says with China out of the market, there's a soybean glut. Farmers are fighting for limited space.
We lost that foreign market, so a lot of the elevators still had soybeans in them that would have been shipped out. And without that market, our silos are filling up with soybeans.
Gordon says he has enough space on his farm to store all of his soybeans. North Dakota farmer Bill Hale says his soybeans are also safe while he looks for a place to sell them. But he says some of his neighbors weren't so lucky.
I've seen soybeans in white plastic bags out in fields. Those are the folks that are in danger. And there are soybeans that are being stored just in piles outside. And if they don't find someplace to go pretty soon, rain and snow will ruin those.
He's 64 and says he's going to retire next year. He's leaving the farm to his son, but says he's worried about the long-term viability of the business. He thinks banks are going to stop offering critical loans. Soybean farmers need to assure lenders they can get an adequate price for their crop.
They're going to have to go in and talk about renewing their operating loan for next year. And I really wonder what price per bushel bankers are going to be able to use if there's no light at the end of the tunnel on the soybean war.
Last year, the U.S. exported $26 billion in soybeans. More than half went to China. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Another installment today of what is becoming a semi-regular feature of American business news. What is going on with GE? General Electric, whose founder, remember, invented the light bulb, said today it's selling off its LED lighting business. In the past couple of years, the company's been selling pieces of itself off like a Halloween store in November. But who exactly is buying those GE cast-offs? And more importantly, why? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
GE's LED division sells lighting to commercial businesses like offices, shopping centers, and factories. Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan says there's a big market for that kind of lighting.
Because LED lighting is really energy efficient. So there's still some growth in this business, and there's still some profit margin.
The buyer is a private equity firm called American Industrial Partners. It owns other companies in aerospace, shipping, and computer hardware. Donna Hittrich at the Columbia Business School says LED lighting might fit right in with those other businesses.
To the extent it has other industrial properties that it can add on or augment this business, that would be very helpful.
That's because American Industrial Partners says it's in a position to invest in LED lighting. GE, on the other hand, has been struggling to find cash.
With a lot of other things on GE's plate right now, it's not surprising that there may be a better suited owner for the business than GE itself.
GE says it wants to focus on its power generation business, along with aircraft engines and renewable energy. GE has already sold some high-profile businesses like NBC Universal and its appliance division. It's also been trying to sell its entire consumer lighting business for years. Lawrence White is a professor of economics at NYU.
They're going to be left with a smaller company that the current senior management thinks they can manage more effectively.
He says a smaller company could be more profitable, too. GE stock is down 70% from a year ago. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Ten years ago this week, November the 4th, actually, 2008, Election Day was happening in very different economic times, deep in the financial crisis, and amazingly enough, not yet at the worst point of the recession. We've been covering the past 10 years in this economy and what it's meant for the people living and working in it in our series, How We Changed. Today, from Graysonville, Maryland, Beth Jacobson.
I was the top loan officer in the country for all of Wells Fargo in the subprime division. They hired me in 1998, and I was producing about $55 million of subprime loans per year. It was 100% commission, so the harder you work, the more money you were able to make. I probably worked 60 hours a week easily. And if somebody walked into the office and they were actually qualified for a prime loan, you had to figure out a way to take them subprime. We got a lot of perks, an incredible paycheck, and the annual sales conference. Usually it was in February in someplace warm. The musical guests were just phenomenal. The Eagles, Cher, Jimmy Buffett, Aerosmith, Elton John, and then they would lavish you with gifts. However, I actually thought I was helping people, especially people that had credit issues. I knew I wasn't selling the products in the subprime division for somebody to be in there 30 years. That was never the intention. They were supposed to refinance it out of 2 years. And for a while, that did work. I was there for 7 years. I probably originated 600 loans. November of 2007, I saw that the subprime loans were shriveling, and then I quit. As I started to see what was happening with the economy and then the bailouts coming, I'm thinking, wow, I was living through this, I was participating in this, but I certainly didn't see this coming. During that time, I started to work at a nonprofit in foreclosure defense, helping homeowners. Ironically, over the years, I have met several of those people whose loans that I originated, and I'm happy to say that I have successfully assisted them in modifying their loans. I was back to working 60 hours a week, but for pennies on the dollars compared to Wells Fargo. But I also know I do strike a little chord of fear in the bank. If I go into mediation with a homeowner, they know I know my numbers, and I'm going to advocate for that homeowner. And that's something that you can't appreciate in a paycheck.
Beth Jacobson, we ought to tell you, was a whistleblower in a 2012 case that alleged Wells Fargo targeted black communities for subprime loans in Baltimore. The bank settled that case for $175 million. We've got a picture or two of Beth on our Instagram, at MarketplaceAPM is us. And while you're there, if you don't mind, take a second. Tell us how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Change. Coming up.
About half of us view our pets as our children or our best friends.
Yeah, very expensive children are best friends. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 173 today, 2/3 of 1%, 25,635. The NASDAQ up 47 points, about 0.6%, 73.75. The S&P 500 advanced 17 points, also 0.6%, 27.55 there. Talked about soybeans. Now that China's no longer buying much, so look at Bayer, the company that recently took over what was once Monsanto, the seed giant, including, by the way, soybean seeds. Bayer withered more than 0.25% today. Ag giant Archer Daniels Midland, which makes soybean oil dip, 1.6% today. As we said, General Electric is turning off the lights on its LED business. GE powered up 1.5%. The LED lighting company Cree brightened at 2% today. Bond prices, well, they fell, thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.22%. And you, yeah, you right there. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Atlantic hurricane season does still have a couple of more weeks to go till the end of November officially, but this year has already been deadly and destructive, mainly from Hurricane Michael last month and Florence in September. And those storms did damage well inland, too. From WUNC, Jay Price has the story of one economically struggling town that can't seem to catch a hurricane break.
For decades, Randy Britt and his family have run adjacent hardware and clothing shops in the historic downtown of Fairbluff, a small town about 70 miles west of Wilmington. We've all seen towns like Fairbluff, storefronts lining both sides of a main street. But in this case, those storefronts are empty because the nearby Lumber River has flooded twice in 2 years, most recently because of Hurricane Florence. For weeks, Britt has left the doors open and blown air through with industrial-sized fans. He's cleaned out most of the silty mud.
When Matthew came, there were clothes in here and slime and everything laying, you know, that deep all over the place.
He holds his hands maybe a foot apart.
I can smell the mold.
Okay, get stronger in here.
Hurricane Matthew struck in 2016, forcing the 15 or so shops along Main Street to close, including Britt's. Fairbluff was a ghost town for 2 years as local officials worked with state and federal agencies on recovery plans. About 5 stores were able to reopen, and then Florence hit. Then all closed again. Britt's trying to make ends meet selling and servicing power equipment like chainsaws out of a small back room. He walks me over to the main part of the hardware store where dirty packets of hinges and screws still hang.
When you come in here in the morning, you see that steam that's drying out on the windows now? It's a hot, slimy feeling. I mean, it's terrible.
Britt, 71, has lived here his whole life. And now, in just 2 years, Britt's shop, plus the only other hardware store, the only appliance and furniture store, the only pharmacy, the only doctor's office, have all closed.
It's like dividing your life up on a line here and cutting out percentages of it as these things leave. Yeah, that you just cut a section of your heart out.
FEMA says nearly 40% of small businesses never reopen after a disaster, and many that do reopen fail within a year. In Fairbluff, there's talk of bulldozing downtown and moving it to higher ground. Mayor Billy Hammond says it's unclear where the money for that would come from, but it's worth considering if the town is to survive.
People's not going to come into town to build a new home or a new store in a floodplain.
Britt, who blames climate change for the floods, says that might be the only solution that makes sense because...
This is probably going to happen again. I'm convinced now. Weather patterns have changed.
If the relocation happens, Britt wouldn't be going with it. He says he's too old to start over. His business was doing little more than paying its bills, even before the storms. Even as the population dwindled, Britt was determined to stay open. He was providing a service to his neighbors. That feeling is common in declining small towns, says Stephen Kahn. He's a historian at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, who studies American cities.
A lot of these small businesses in these communities, I think, don't see themselves entirely as a profit-making enterprise, as they balance that against that sense of community cohesion, that these places, they're run by people in the community, they're run for people in the community.
And so walking away from these businesses is hard emotionally, even if it's wise financially. In Fairbluff, North Carolina, I'm Jay Price for Marketplace.
Took my dog to the vet last night, a couple of shots and a checkup. My family's contribution to the more than $70 billion the American Pet Products Association figures we are going to spend on our pets this year. Something like $30 billion of that total is going to be on food. And as KCUR's Peggy Lowe reports now from Kansas City, we ain't just talking puppy chow.
Ruby, come here.
Welcome to Sarah Brock's home in suburban Kansas City, where she and her two-year-old are showing off the skills of their dog, Ruby.
Beg! Beg! Oh, that was speak. Let's try it again.
Ruby is a six-year-old mutt, part Sharpei, part Lab, and maybe a little German Shepherd. Brock and her husband have two children, but they had Ruby first and call her their fur child, which was a little hard to explain to Sarah's dad.
And he thought I was talking about a real baby at first. I go, no, Dad, our fur child. She's our, like, our baby.
About half of us view our pets as our children or our best friends, which is very sweet and a little sad, I think.
Lynn Dornblasser is laughing because she admits that she falls into that camp about her own cats. Dornblasser is Director of Innovation and Insight for Mintel, a market research firm. She found that pet owners are buying the kind of food that they seek for themselves, products with labels claiming they're free of preservatives and high in protein.
You see companies talking about meat as the first ingredient, or only whole grains, or showing pictures of the kinds of meat and the fruits and the vegetables that are in that product.
During the last decade, demand for this premium pet food boosted sales dramatically. Nielsen, the consumer research company, reports that annual household spending on pet food increased 36% from 2007 through 2017. A large part of that, the prices. So here at my local grocery store, I'm looking at a can of Purina Alpo, the old school dog food, 85 cents. Right next to it is the Purina brand called Beyond, grain-free chicken and sweet potato recipe made with real chicken. It's $1.85, so that's a dollar more for the premium pet food.
We've seen more of a shift away from ingredients that consumers don't understand very well. So that means words that sound like scary chemicals.
Steve Akins is with Watt Global Media, which focuses on the animal food industry. I talked to him at a pet food showcase in Manhattan, Kansas recently. He says this high-end pet food trend is called
humanization, treating them as a member of the family. And it's really a member of the family that can't speak for themselves. And so we humanize what we think are their responses or the way they're thinking.
Back at Sarah Brock's home, Ruby has a lineup of treats. First thing in the morning, she gets a dental bone. Later in the day, it's more indulgent. Ruby loves whipped cream out of an aerosol can.
Ruby, speak.
As more of us feed our pets like humans, Fido and Fluffy might also be susceptible to one of our problems. The Association for Pet Obesity Prevention says an estimated 60% of cats and 56% of dogs are overweight in the U.S. In Kansas City, I'm Peggy Lowe for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out, in which the future of political advertising does seem to be upon us. Saw this in Bloomberg today. Facebook and Google and all the rest may still be trying to figure out how not to be dupes in the influence sweepstakes that is political ads online. But they are laughing all the way to the bank. A market research firm called Borrell estimates total online political ad spending this cycle hit almost $1.8 billion. Here's the kicker. That's up 25% from midterms 4 years ago. One can only imagine what 2020 is going to be like. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 173 on this election day. That is 2/3 of 1%. NASDAQ gained 47 points, about 0.6%. S&P 500 up 0.6% as well, 17 points on that particular index. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital here. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.